Welcome to Poems for Company. I'm your host, Brian Dillon. Imagine if you were cast up alone on an island, entirely without books. Would you carry inside any entire poems? Do you know any poems by heart? Which is a lovely phrase. Perhaps you would fondly recall some song lyrics. In the first poem I'll read today, the poet depicts Robinson Crusoe back in England, reflecting on his solitary time on an island, and he tells us there was a snippet of a poem that he carried within him, but he could not recall how the lines continued. Bookless on his island, all he could remember was a fragment, a frustrating fragment. We will hear more about this in just a few moments. Even if you never read Daniel Defoe's novel Robinson Crusoe, the story is part of our cultural inheritance. Born in England, Crusoe washes ashore on an uninhabited island where he lives for over 27 years, most of that time in solitary confinement. He's our culture's best-known survivalist. He figures out how to feed himself, constructs two shelters, and endures an abundance of time in which he ponders why the divine power he believes in chose to punish him. After roughly a quarter of a century of solitude, the young man Friday comes ashore, a cannibal, fleeing other cannibals. In the poem, Crusoe in England, by the 20th century American writer Elizabeth Bishop, Robinson Crusoe is an old man back in England and wondering if this island of his origin, the place where his life will come to a close, is truly his home. Or was he more at home when cast away on his other, unnamed, totally remote island? Bishop's poem is longish. Crusoe shares specific recollections of the only life he knew for so long, a life more charged with meaning than his current life. And that takes us to today's theme. Where is my home? For Crusoe, and maybe for you, a place from the past seems to fit the concept of home best. This is Elizabeth Bishop's poem, Crusoe in England. A new volcano has erupted, the papers say, and last week I was reading where some ship saw an island being born. At first, a breath of steam 10 miles away, and then a black fleck, basalt probably, rose in the mate's binoculars and caught on the horizon like a fly. They named it. But my poor old island's still unrediscovered, unrenameable. None of the books has ever got it right. Well, I have 52 miserable small volcanoes I could climb with a few slithery strides. Volcanoes dead as ash heaps. I used to sit on the edge of the highest one and count the others standing up, naked and leaden, with their heads blown off. I'd think that if they were the size I thought volcanoes should be, then I have become a giant, and if I had become a giant, I couldn't bear to think what size the goats and turtles were, or the gulls, or the overlapping rollers, a glittering hexagon of rollers, closing and closing in, but never quite, glittering and glittering, though the sky was mostly overcast. My island seemed to be a sort of cloud dump. All the hemisphere's leftover clouds arrived and hung above the craters. Their parched throats were hot to touch. Was that why it rained so much, and why sometimes the whole place hissed? The turtles lumbered by, high-domed, hissing like tea kettles. And I'd have given years, or taken a few, for any sort of kettle, of course. The folds of lava, running out to sea, would hiss, I'd turn, and then they'd prove to be more turtles. The beaches were all lava, variegated, black, red, and white, and gray. The marbled colors made a fine display. And I had water spouts. Oh, half a dozen at a time, far out, they come and go, advancing and retreating, their heads in clouds, their feet in moving patches of scuffed-up white. Glass chimneys, flexible, attenuated, sacerdotal beings of glass. I watched the water spiral up in them like smoke. Beautiful, yes, but not much company. I often gave way to self-pity. Do I deserve this? I suppose I must. I wouldn't be here otherwise. Was there a moment when I actually chose this? I don't remember, but there could have been. What's wrong about self-pity, anyway? With my legs dangling down familiarly over a crater's edge, I told myself pity should begin at home. So the more pity I felt, the more I felt at home. The sun set in the sea. The same old sun rose from the sea, and there was one of it and one of me. The island had one kind of everything. One tree snail, a bright violet blue, with a thin shell, crept over everything, over the variety of tree, a sooty scrub affair. Small shells lay under these in drifts, and at a distance you'd swear that they were beds of irises. There was one kind of berry, a dark red. I tried it, one by one, and hours apart. Subacid, and not bad, no ill effects, and so I made homebrew. I drink the awful fizzy stinging stuff that went straight to my head and play my homemade flute. I think it had the weirdest scale on earth. And dizzy, whoop and dance among the goats. Homemade, homemade, but aren't we all? I felt a deep affection for the smallest of my island industries. No, not exactly, since the smallest was a miserable philosophy. Because I didn't know enough, why didn't I know enough of something? Greek drama or astronomy? The books I'd read were full of blanks. The poems, well, I tried reciting to my iris beds. They flash upon that inward eye, which is the bliss. The bliss of what? One of the first things that I did when I got back was look it up. The island smelled of goat and guano. The goats were white, so were the gulls, and both too tame, or else they thought I was a goat too, or a gull. Bah, 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 and shriek, 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 bah, shriek, bah. I still can't shake them from my ears. They're hurting now. The questioning shrieks, the equivocal replies over a ground of hissing rain and hissing, ambulating turtles got on my nerves. When all the gulls flew up at once, they sounded like a big tree in a strong wind, its leaves. I'd shut my eyes and think about a tree, an oak, say, with real shade somewhere. I'd heard of cattle getting island sick. I thought the goats were. One billy goat would stand on the volcano I'd christen Mont d'Espoir, or Mount Despair, I'd time enough to play with names, and bleat and bleat and sniff the air. I'd grab his beard and look at him, his pupils horizontal, narrowed up, and expressed nothing, or a little malice. I got so tired of the very colors. One day, I dyed a baby goat bright red with my red berries, just to see something a little different, and then his mother wouldn't recognize him. Dreams were the worst. Of course, I dreamed of food and love, but they were pleasant rather than otherwise. But then I'd dream of things like slitting a baby's throat, mistaking it for a baby goat. I'd have nightmares of other islands stretching away from mine, infinities of islands, islands spawning islands, like frogs' eggs turned into polywogs of islands, knowing that I had to live on each and every one eventually for ages, registering their flora, their fauna, their geography. Just when I thought I couldn't stand it another minute longer, Friday came. Accounts of that have everything all wrong. Friday was nice. Friday was nice, and we were friends. If only he had been a woman. I wanted to propagate my kind, and so did he, I think, poor boy. He'd pat the baby goats sometimes and race with them, or carry one around. Pretty to watch. He had a pretty body. And then one day they came and took us off. Now I live here. Another island that doesn't seem like one, but who decides? My blood was full of them. My brain bred islands, but that archipelago has petered out. I'm old. I'm bored, too, drinking my real tea surrounded by uninteresting lumber. The knife there on the shelf, it reeked of meaning like a crucifix. It lived. How many years did I beg it, implore it not to break? I knew each nick and scratch by heart, the bluish blade, the broken tip, the lines of wood grain on the handle. Now it won't look at me at all. The living soul has dribbled away. My eyes rest on it and pass on. The local museums asked me to leave everything to them. The flute, the knife, the shriveled shoes, my shredding goatskin trousers. Moths have got in the fur. The parasol that took me such a time remembering the way the ribs should go. It still will work, but folded up, looks like a plucked and skinny fowl. How can anyone want such things? And Friday, my dear Friday, died of measles 17 years ago come March. That's Elizabeth Bishop's Crusoe in England. Bishop's Crusoe feels full of self-pity. Pity should begin at home, he says. So the more pity I felt, the more I felt at home. What seems most curious is that Crusoe felt most alive when at home on his island. From the one dark red berry on his island, he'd make a fizzy drink, and, dizzy, whoop and dance among the goats. Homemade, homemade, but aren't we all? Now, on the other island of England, that doesn't seem like an island to him, probably because he's away from the sea and spends too much time indoors. He drinks real tea and is bored. He implies the tea in England just does not compare to his homemade berry brew. In his solitary confinement, objects had held a power that now they lack. He says the knife there on the shelf, it reeked of meaning like a crucifix. It lived. How many years did I beg it, implore it, not to break? I knew each nick and scratch by heart, the bluish blade, the broken tip, the lines of wood grain on the handle. Now it won't look at me at all. The living soul has dribbled away. My eyes rest on it and pass on. The local museums asked me to leave everything to them. Crusoe's convinced that museum-goers staring at these artifacts from his island life will not be able to imagine the mysterious power these objects held for him for so many years. The flute, the shriveled shoes, the goatskin trousers, the parasol, and the most important object, the knife. Now it won't look at me at all. The living soul has dribbled away. These objects he relied on for decades have lost their aura, their living soul. Earlier in this lengthy poem, he admits, I felt a deep affection for the smallest of my island industries, those manufacturing tasks he carried out with his knife, the construction of his goatskin trousers, his parasol. But then he corrects himself, as though he fears he's romanticizing his decades alone. I felt a deep affection for the smallest of my island industries. No, not exactly, since the smallest was a miserable philosophy. He then scolds himself for not knowing any poem by heart. Because I didn't know enough. Why didn't I know enough of something, Greek drama or astronomy? The books I'd read were full of blanks. The poems, well, I tried reading to my iris beds. They flash upon that inward eye, which is the bliss. The bliss of what? One of the first things that I did when I got back was look it up. Curiously, Crusoe does not tell us what the missing word is, nor does he identify the poem he only recalled as a fragment. The lines he quotes are from William Wordsworth's poem, I Wandered Lonely as a Cloud. Perfect for Crusoe to think of, because the cloud cover on his island was the weather element that most stood out for him. My island seemed to be a sort of cloud dump. All the hemisphere's leftover clouds arrived and hung over the 52 miserable small volcanoes. But Wordsworth's I Wandered Lonely as a Cloud is also a perfect poem for Crusoe to think of, because he faced loneliness every day of his many years alone. Wordsworth's speaker recalls his lonely wandering experience interrupted by a vision of a crowd of golden daffodils stretching in a never-ending line along the margin of a bay. Crusoe recites part of two lines of Wordsworth's poem, but can't recall a key word, mainly because he does not know what the missing word's rhyming partner is. So, here are the key lines from Wordsworth's final stanza. For oft when on my couch I lie, in vacant or in pensive mood, they flash upon that inward eye, which is the bliss of solitude. Had Crusoe been able to recall those first two lines, he would have known the missing word must rhyme with mood. That would have aided his memory. More to the point, the solitary man cannot recall the key term, solitude. That's Elizabeth Bishop's little joke at Robinson Crusoe's expense. The poem emphasizes that Crusoe feels his life is diminished in his old age because he's not at home in England in any comparable way to the home he made for himself on his unnamed island. Elizabeth Bishop's version of Crusoe does not indicate there's any specific person in England that he missed, or anyone now in his old age that comforts him. He does say this, though, about the arrival of Friday on his island, after he had spent so many years alone. "Just when I thought I couldn't stand another minute longer, Friday came. Accounts of that have everything all wrong. Friday was nice. Friday was nice, and we were friends. If only he had been a woman. I wanted to propagate my kind, and so did he, I think, poor boy. He'd pet the baby goats sometimes, and race with them, or carry one around. Pretty to watch. He had a pretty body. And then one day they came and took us off." The poem then closes with this final thought: "And Friday, my dear Friday, died of measles 17 years ago, come March." Now, no one alive can comprehend Crusoe's thoughts of his former home. As he says, none of the books has ever got it right. Do you ever dream about a former landscape you lived in and moved through? Do you carry in your mind images of streets you walked on, of shops and schools and cafes that shaped the extended area you called home? Karen Carson's 1987 poem, The Exiles Club, depicts Irish expatriates in Australia, expats from Belfast, to be specific. These old-timers meet once a week in a bar in Adelaide, Australia, to share their memories of their once-familiar Belfast urban landscape. Let's hear the poem before I talk a bit more about it. This is Karen Carson's The Exiles Club. Every Thursday in the upstairs lounge of the Wollongong Bar, they make themselves at home with Red Heart Stout, Park Drive cigarettes, and Dunville's whiskey, a slightly moldy batch of soda farls. Eventually, they get down to business. After years, they have reconstructed the whole of the Falls Road, and now are working on the back streets, Lemon, Peel and Omar, Balaclava, Alma. They just about keep up with the news of bombings and demolition and are struggling with the finer details, the names and dates carved out on the back bench of the Leavers class in Slate Street School, the Nemo Cafe menu, the effects of the 1941 Blitz, the entire contents of Paddy Lavery's pawn shop. That's The Exiles Club by Karen Carson, C-I-A-R-A-N, Carson, a Belfast-based poet who died in 2019. Carson's speaker may be an omniscient observer of the expatriates' weekly meetings, or maybe even a member, one with a terrific ability to recall specific details. The expats make themselves at home with Red Heart Stout, Park Drive cigarettes, and Dunville's whiskey. Red Heart Stout is a Guinness product. Park Drive cigarettes are made in a factory in Belfast. Perhaps some generous relative left behind in Belfast ships these luxury items to them. Dunville's whiskey comes from a Belfast distillery that, in fact, closed in 1936, so it's most strange that any would still be available in Belfast, let alone Adelaide, in the 70s or 80s. Indulging in these Belfast-produced items warms the men to the task of retrieving their past. How do they reconstruct their former neighborhood? Are they filling out blueprints that correspond to the zone they all once knew? Or are they simply creating a kind of map in their minds about the city they clearly loved and still love? Are they at home at all in Adelaide? The poem indicates these expats meet in the 70s or early 80s. They refer indirectly to the Troubles, the sectarian violence between Protestants and Catholics in their former home city that erupted with bombings in 1969. And these are old-timers. They even go back over three decades or more to reimagine what the city was like before the Blitz, the Nazi bombing of Northern Ireland, Belfast specifically, that occurred in spring of 41. Humor and sadness are evident in their reconstructive efforts. Humor in their obsessive attention to detail, including an effort to itemize the contents of a once familiar pawn shop. Sadness in the realization that it's unlikely they will return to Belfast. Robinson Crusoe does not feel at home in his old age in England. He was most alive and alert and creative with his small volcanoes and hissing turtles on his solitary island, not in his current comfortable civilized residence. Karen Carson's expats are at home in Adelaide only, it seems, when sharing information about their former home. Let's hear Carson's poem once more. Every Thursday in the upstairs lounge of the Wollongong Bar, they make themselves at home with Red Heart Stout, Park Drive cigarettes, and Dumbville's whiskey, a slightly moldy batch of soda farls. Eventually, they get down to business. After years, they have reconstructed the whole of the Falls Road and now are working on the back streets. Lemon, Peel and Omar, Balaclava, Alma. They just about keep up with the news of bombings and demolition and are struggling with the finer details. The names and dates carved out on the back bench of the Leavers class in Slate Street School. The Nemo Cafe menu. The effects of the 1941 Blitz. The entire contents of Paddy Lavery's pawn shop. Karen Carson's The Exiles Club and Elizabeth Bishop's Crusoe in England challenge our complacent views that home must refer to a specific fixed structure where we've invested so many profound emotions. Instead, it may be an extended zone from our past that we visit only metaphorically when we conjure it, a place we carry in our memory. Are you at home listening to this broadcast? This episode is titled, Where is My Home? Part 2 will air next month at this same time, the fourth Monday of the month at 9 a.m. And you may always listen to the podcast whenever that's most convenient. Start from KMUN.org, click on the podcast tab, and click on Poems for Company, and you will find this and all previous episodes along with a list of all the poems read on each show. Thanks for listening to Poems for Company.